Hi everybody, and welcome back to the Heredity Podcast. I'm Mike Poynter. We know how DNA works, right? DNA contains genes, genes code for proteins, and those proteins have biological functions. By changing the base sequence of the gene, you can change the structure of the protein. Well, yes, and as is very often the case, it's a bit more complicated than that. One of the ways that it's more complicated is the topic of today's podcast, alternative splicing. And as I know pretty much nothing about this subject, it's probably safer to go straight away to today's guest. Hi David, thanks for joining me. Would you mind starting us off by telling us a bit about yourself and what you work on and where?
Yes, my name is David Manahan. I am a PhD candidate in Michael Nachman's laboratory here at UC Berkeley in California. I'm also part of the Museum of Vertebrate Zoology. The Nachman Laboratory is broadly interested in the genomics of adaptation and speciation. My particular niche in this research group is the molecular mechanisms and molecular biology underlying adaptation. My background, in undergraduate, most of my training was in molecular and structural biology, and I transitioned more to evolutionary biology and genomics for my PhD.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Next, could you tell us a bit about the background that's set the stage for the paper that we're discussing today?
So, research conducted in Michael Nachman's laboratory utilizes the house mouse model system. Of course, house mice is one of the most popular model organisms, and as a result, there are many resources available to this system, especially genomic resources. The unique angle of Michael Nachman's laboratory is that these wild mice used in our studies, including in this paper, are collected from across populations in North and South America. The idea that these populations are actually allow us to study natural variation and questions in evolution while having the phenomenal resources available because it is a model system.
Nice. Yes, the kind of resources that the rest of us can only dream of.
Yeah, exactly. That's as a member in the Museum of Vertebrate Zoology, that's something that is often brought up from other labs in this institution. But another aspect of these mice is that in addition to being collected from wild populations, there also have been reared in the laboratory. The idea that we can get at the genetic differences because they are raised in a common laboratory environment. However, the mice used in this paper, this hereditary paper, these were wild populations that importantly, you know, when we think about house mice or we have the opportunity to see wild house mice, they're sort of dismissed almost, very small and trying to escape our notice. But in reality, these house mice have very distinct morphological differences. And this is captured in the samples and used in the study. So for example, these mice exist along a latitudinal climb, going from a temperate population in New York, of the United States, going down to a subtropical population in Florida. These mice we know are locally adapted. For example, body size is a main distinguishing and a heritable trait in these populations that we are thought could be related to thermoregulation.
Great. So then, what were your aims in this recent study?
So the Nachman Lab has a history of looking at transcription, which is generally referred to as gene expression, and its involvement in adaptation. Sort of my background in molecular and structural biology, something that loomed large on my mind was, well, gene expression is actually a very complex process, going all the way from, you know, the regulation of accessibility to chromatin 4 transcription all the way to the final protein product and post-translational modifications said to that product. And these multitude of steps could provide an opportunity for adaptation and evolution, just a regulation of what this final product might look like. So in this study, we set out to look at gene expression from a different perspective, namely a post-transcriptional perspective. Early in my PhD, there were some papers that came out with some new algorithms that enabled me to survey old RNA-seq, you know, short-read, Illumina-generated gene expression data to look at it from a different perspective. And we wanted to see if this other expression mechanism, the alternative splicing, could be facilitating adaptation.
Okay, wonderful. Now, this is not something that I know much about at all. So this seems like a good point for you to explain to me exactly what alternative splicing is.
Yes. So in eukaryotes, protein coding genes are not a contiguous set of sequences. Rather, they have multitude of protein coding regions referred to as exons that in combination form a processed mRNA that then can be translated into whatever protein it codes for. This structure enables actually the inclusion and exclusion, or rather splicing together of different exons in different combinations, which effectively can create different proteins and altering their function and folding.
Okay, so a gene is not a gene, but many potential genes.
Yes, exactly. The one gene, one protein from beetle does not quite hold up when you consider post-transcriptional processing.
Great. So you're trying to look at the contribution that alternative splicing makes to the adaptation of the mice living across this temperature gradient.
That's exactly correct. And little fun story, this project originally started as a COVID-19 lockdown project when there was limited accessibility to the wet lab. The data collected in this paper was actually originally published in former grad students, now Professor Katia Almack at University of Kansas, this paper looking at the same latitudinal cline, but from a transcription perspective. And the goal here was to analyze the same data so that we could be able to compare these two mechanisms, i.e. transcription and alternative splicing, side by side. And in looking at the alternative splicing going on in these populations, it was very readily apparent that something was going on, and they were, in fact, having a different result than what was seen with transcription. And this paper sort of investigates that further.
That's super interesting. So usually at this point, I ask people about collecting their samples, but it sounds like you didn't collect the samples here.
That's correct. I did not. But I think it's important to mention, I mentioned earlier for the background of the study that the lab utilizes these wild populations of house mice as sort of this rich model of genomic resources that also reflects natural variation. These wild populations used in the study were originally collected for the establishment of these in-laboratory colonies, but these are the wild collections.
Okay, but they were collected for this previous study, whose data you've now processed in a different way to look at alternative splicing.
Yes.
Well, that brings us neatly onto the nitty-gritty of the methods. I know that you didn't generate the data, but perhaps give us a bit of an idea of what you were working with in terms of sequences, and then let us know how you processed them, because I know nothing about the kind of approaches you must have used here.
Great. So the data used in this paper was RNA sequencing data. These are generated from the Illumina company, which I think is pretty familiar with those in this field. But specifically, this is used on reverse transcribed RNA, i.e. cDNA. And what's important here to note is that being Illumina, these are the more traditional short reads. I believe in this paper, the reads were 150 base pairs in length. And the idea that the abundance levels of these reads are reflecting the expression level of whatever gene they came from. When we're talking about alternative splicing, you might have an instance where you have different isoforms, an isoform being defined as different variations of the processed mRNA that is ultimately exported to the cytosol for translation by a ribosome. But it's often case, okay, you know, we might have three different isoforms with the same exon expressed in each isoform. So it's hard from short read data to look at differential isoform usage or alternative splicing due to sort of redundancy and exon usage. So I mentioned that there were some papers that came out early in my PhD, some new algorithms that enabled the surveying of RNA-seq data. One of them is from Jonathan Pritchard's lab at Stanford University, a little south, called Leafcutter. And what this does is it looks at all of the reads generated from an RNA-seq library and specifically looks for reads that when you map them back to a genome, as you do for normal RNA-seq processing, when you map it back to the genome, they're looking for reads that map to two different loci in a gene. So this is also a benefit of having a well-annotated model organism like mice, because we also will know if it's being mapped back to two different annotated exons. And these split reads, as they are referred to, because they split to two different loci in a gene, is direct evidence of alternative splicing that has been captured by your sequencing. And so measuring the abundance of these split reads allows basically us to infer the frequency of alternative splicing events in this data.
Okay, amazing. And extremely well explained.
Thank you.
So you're able to say that splicing is happening here, but it doesn't give you sufficient resolution to say that this gene is being spliced as these certain combinations of exons.
So there are different programs and algorithms to query alternative splicing with short read Illumina data. Each have their sort of advantages and disadvantages. So the Leafcutter program is explicitly looking at excision, is defined by the excision of sequences. Because namely, if you have a split read, that means the part that was between them and that your reference has been cut out. So it is unable to inform you on different types of alternative splicing events, whether it's like an exon extension or truncation or an intron inclusion of some kind. To get at that, actually, sort of what's motivating my current research, which is the idea of using new third or fourth generation sequencing technologies, whether it's PacBio or Oxford Nanopore, to generate long read sequencing data to capture whole isoforms to sort of quantify these alternative splicing events. However, that's not included in this paper, but it's something I look forward to sharing soon.
Okay, nice. It's great to know where you're heading next. But sticking with this paper, we've made it to the results. So tell us what you found.
So first and foremost, yes, there is alternative splicing going on in these animals. But importantly, I mentioned that the limitations of short read Illumina data or these RNA-seq libraries is that, well, we're throwing out a lot of reads, essentially, because, of course, I think it ended up being about 40% of reads were these split reads that could be actually used to look at splicing. So that you do have less power to detect, you know, alternative splicing differences and look at how it is involved in adaptation. So to identify candidates that are involved or underlying local adaptation in these populations, we also, in addition to looking at differential splicing, took these results and then passed them through further tests, essentially, to see if we could find consistency with signals of selection. So, for example, these mice, they live on a latitudinal cline. If you are able to sort of remove environmental differences in your model, variation along that cline, so along a gradient, I should say, could be reflective of local adaptation. So we took differentially expressed genes, looked for gradients in splicing levels across this cline. And furthermore, these populations also have some genomic data, namely exome capture sequences. And it was on these that previous studies from the lab have actually done tests of selection. And then we took those, you know, differentially spliced and clinally splicing genes and overlapped them and looked at see if they fell in the same region of signatures of selection such that we could identify splicing QTL or cis-sqtl, splicing QTL that are near our gene of interest that are overlapping with signature or evolving alongside a SNP that is under selection. So in this way, we arrived at a small set of genes that we are confident are underlying adaptation in these populations due to alternative splicing.
And I realize that this might be asking a lot, but are you able to say anything about the functions of those genes?
So another benefit of working in mice is that there's also a lot of databases on sort of functional annotations of these genes. A large number of these genes were associated to be affecting body size, which is somewhat encouraging because we know body size differentiates between populations along this cline. Also, there looked to be an enrichment for involvement in the complement system, which is basically a function of the immune system. But in sort of speaking confidently about the function of these genes, as someone with a molecular biology and structural biology background and a lot of training, is not something I feel confident on speaking on yet. For example, if you have any mutation that results in sort of a suboptimal or sick phenotype, you know, that often will result in a smaller body size. So it's hard to tell. One reason I think alternative splicing actually is so exciting is that there is the increased ability to predict 3D protein structure now in 2024. Some about these we heard about in the news, like AlphaFold, but these are very real technologies that are used in academic contexts. And what's really exciting to me, you know, having seen this being done while an undergraduate for X-ray crystallography, there is an ability to predict what protein domains are being affected due to splicing. And that's actually something I'm very excited in and sort of something I aim to make a future direction to sort of answer that question with a little more confidence.
Okay, so what's the take-home message that you'd like people to go away with from either reading the paper or listening to us talking about it today?
An important aspect of this paper I mentioned was that it was examining pre-existing data that was used to study adaptation through transcription. And by doing similar tests to identify candidates of adaptation, we're able to compare these two mechanisms of transcription and alternative splicing side by side. And in usually in science, in biology and science in general, if the question is, how does A, B, or C, you know, contribute to said process? The answer is usually, oh, it's some combination. Furthermore, the molecular biology of transcription and splicing is in eukaryotes is that while concurrently with transcription, the nascent mRNA strand is actually spliced to the final mRNA product concurrently. So the expectation we had was that this would be happening, you know, we would see overlapping in candidate genes, i.e. both mechanisms would be contributing to adaptation. What we found was completely the opposite. After doing all these tests to identify candidates of adaptation, the candidates did not overlap at all. This seems to suggest that it is possible that these two mechanisms actually in the context of adaptation might be fulfilling completely separate and unique roles, which, you know, does warrant further looking into, hence these follow-up projects looking at these long-read whole isoform data. But I think it's very exciting because the next obvious question from, you know, this result of this non-overlap is, what about splicing enables it to impact proteins and RNAs in a way that transcription levels cannot? So that's, I think, a very exciting direction, and there's a lot to explore that I look forward to sharing in due time.
I completely agree. Very exciting, and lots to keep you busy by the sounds of it. To round us off, would you please remind us of the title of the paper and give credit to those people that deserve it for their contribution?
This is Alternative Splicing and Environmental Adaptation in Wild House Mice. I'd like to thank my advisor and co-author, Michael Nachman. Additionally, I'd like to thank Dr. Katya L. Mack and Dr. Mallory Ballinger, who have previously worked on this data that was analyzed in the study, as well as Dr. Megan Pfeiffer-Rixey, who collected these animals originally and also provided the exome capture data. A lot of this data was a lot of statistics questions and computational questions, and I really have to thank my fiance, frankly. She is very involved in data science and has been the best technical support that anyone could ask for. Like, she has an acknowledgement in the paper because she helped me a lot. Yeah.
And with that, all that remains is for me to thank you, David, for joining me. Thank you very much. That was David Manahan. I'm really looking forward to seeing those follow-up studies he mentioned, as well as the other studies looking at the contribution of alternative splicing to adaptation that will no doubt appear in Heredity in the future. To read David's paper, head to the Heredity website, nature.com/HDY, where you can also find out how to submit your own work to the journal. Heredity is the official journal of the Genetic Society, one of the world's oldest learned societies, which is dedicated to the study and communication of genetics. I'm Mike Poynter. This has been the Heredity Podcast. See you next time. Thanks for listening.